dark, dark world contains strong language and depictions of sex, violence, and sexual violence. Please use discretion when listening to our episodes.
She's got her darling baby playing in the playroom, and then images in her head of,
I'm gonna kill you, fucking bitch.
Wild. How did they get those recordings?
By the way, that was my impression of voicemails that the Golden State Killer was leaving. That was, in case you don't know what the hell that was. So, back by popular demand, ladies and gentlemen and non-gender conforming persons across the world, my kid brother, Devin Crittenden.
Bam, bam, bam. Bam, 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 bam. Happy to be here, Jord. Thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. We're going to do an installment of Doc Doc World, and this couldn't be more timely because we're doing I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which just finished. The finale episode was this past Sunday. We're recording this on the Tuesday following it. Let's jump right in, bro. I was thinking about this, actually. This isn't really the kind of thing that we can spoil. I was going to say, you know, if you haven't seen it, don't listen because of spoilers. But there are two key points about this story. One, I mean, if you know anything about it, you know it's about the Golden State Killer. Well, we know he's been caught, right? So we know that's coming. And if you know anything about Michelle McNamara, the author of the book that this is based on, you know her story, you know that she is dead. And you can tell that pretty early in the series because she's never shown. She's not a talking head. Her husband, Patton Oswalt, has to do it for her. So that's clear even if you didn't know that. Did you know she was dead going into this?
I did. I knew a little bit about Golden State Killer and I knew sort of the Michelle McNamara story because it was very recent that he was actually caught, right? I mean, in terms of real time, it was like last year or within a year or so.
Yeah, 2018. Mm-hmm. The end of 2018. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I knew just sort of like the overall story, but the doc is so well made that it doesn't really matter, I think, if you know all the, even if you know a lot, even if you've read the book, I still think you get a ton out of just watching the doc series.
Yeah, I agree. And I hadn't read the book, but I was wondering how they were going to do it. You know, how are you going to tell, you know, is this a Golden State Killer doc or is this really a doc version of the book? And how would you do that? And I got my answer. They did it very well by telling essentially two stories. They're telling the story of true crime writer Michelle McNamara, and through that vehicle they're telling the story of the Golden State Killer, the East Area Rapist. He's got all kinds of names, but so it's really two stories that are going on. They're showing us how Michelle McNamara was living her life as a crime writer, and then she stumbled onto this case and was shocked that it wasn't bigger and really devoted a lot of time to trying to solve it. And so you get both of these stories, and that was kind of fun. Did you like that?
Yeah, I loved it. And just the way it's put together, I actually found myself a little more interested in Michelle's story possibly than the actual killer, but maybe that's just because we already knew who he was. I think if there was still we knew he had been caught by the time we watched the documentary. So if you hadn't known that, I mean, maybe that would have been more interesting, but I was really just enthralled by her story. And then, I mean, she, you know, you don't want to say that she, like, solved the case, but maybe. I mean, she certainly brought the attention to it, the nationwide attention that I feel like really brought people, brought interest toward it, made them reopen these investigations of cold cases. She also linked together some of the crimes, right? Because he had hit multiple areas up and down the state of California, and then she sort of linked some of those, right? Because there's East Area Rapist. He has another name. Something else. And she coined Golden State Killer, right?
That, whether she coined it, I'm not certain, but you're right. She brought together different police departments that were dealing with him under different names. The Visalia Strangler, was that one of them?
Yeah.
So, yeah, all these different, you know, detectives working in different cities, not really sharing information, and so she was instrumental in bringing that information together and working with these people. And she was also, I think, the way that the documentary presented it was that she was the one who had the idea to use genetic genealogy for this, like the 23andMe, the Ancestry.com, like knowing that early on that that would be a crime-solving tool. She was pushing that pretty hard, and other people weren't thinking about that avenue, and ultimately that's what got him caught.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to dive in here. Like, I do want to talk a lot about Michelle and her, like, clear, I think you could say, obsession. I mean, that drove her to write this book and investigate these crimes. But I also found it really interesting in the final episode when they catch him. And he's in the courtroom, and he's this frail old man, and they go to the victims, who are all, like, first of all, just so brave, willing to be on camera and talk about this stuff. But and some of them said, like, you know, I wish he wasn't caught. You know, maybe they have to relive all that over again. But I thought that was, like, that blew my mind. Just thinking, oh wow, it's sort of beyond justice now. It's almost like too little too late in a weird way.
Yes. In fact, that was a prompt. That was something I wanted to talk about. So since you brought it up, we'll just get into it now. This, I think maybe people didn't realize it. I'm curious if you had these thoughts, but it's super timely for what's going on right now with these movements for abolishing police and defunding police, getting rid of prisons, because what I noticed, and exactly what you just described there, one of the victims, and I should have written her name down, so apologies for that, but she was really emotional, crying after his trial, after his sentencing, and she actually said that she couldn't explain why she was crying, and there was just a general feeling, like you mentioned, when it shows the victims, this old frail man is being sentenced, there's no real satisfaction on any of their faces. They don't seem like, it's not the conclusion that they were hoping for, is what it felt like to me. One of the women who sort of became her own citizen detective on the case, you know, she said she wanted to start doing her own investigation of D'Angelo just to find out what made him tick, because I think she and the other victims, they wanted more, and it wasn't, there's no justice. They sort of realized that as they get to the end of this, when he wasn't caught, they were hopeful still. There was like, he's out there and they haven't got him yet. And when that happens, it's going to be great. So then when it finally does happen and it's kind of not great, it was actually better when he wasn't caught. Now he's caught and they realize, oh, it didn't do for me what I thought it was going to do. And I think that speaks a lot to our justice system in that, you know, it's punishment. The guy's getting punished. But that didn't make anything really feel better for any of these women. And I think that's so often the case. There's all this importance placed on catching the guy and punishing him. And then we find that that really doesn't make us feel any better about the harms that were done to us. And that seems so clear to me on all of their faces. Did you make that connection at all?
I definitely thought about the, you know, all cops are bastards, like ACAB stuff, just watching it, because he himself was a cop. In fact, part of the burglary unit. So he knew how to get into people's homes because his specific job was to stop people doing that, which is just a whole different thing. But in terms of the victims, I think, you know, I don't know. I think it's just so complicated. I think it's like beyond anything you or I could really even empathize with or understand fully. But I feel like the disappointment to me is that it took them so goddamn long. Like, he lived, did these heinous crimes, got away with it, lived a seemingly normal suburban life. And that's, I think, that's the part that doesn't sit well, is that you think, man, this guy got to live. And it was blowing my mind when they, I think it's the two journalists that worked with Michelle, or maybe they're part of the documentary crew, and they go in front of his house and they just kind of look at it and stand there. And it just hit me like, oh, wow, this piece of shit lives better than I do. I mean, he had a better life than a lot of people, living this suburban, almost like picturesque American dream life. And so that's what's so upsetting about it. That's why I think it doesn't leave a good taste in your mouth. I'm not sure that it's the entirety of the justice system as much as, like, it took them so long to catch him that now it's like, well, his punishment actually isn't really satisfying in any way.
Yeah. A couple things there just to finish this justice point. The last thing you said, it's, have you seen Athlete A, the documentary about Larry Nassar, the U.S. gymnastics molester?
I know who he is, but I haven't seen the documentary.
Great documentary. Highly recommend it to everybody. But when he was sentenced for his crimes, a huge cathartic piece of the justice for his victims was that they all got to come up and make a witness or a victim statement to Larry. And it's really emotional and tense in the documentary. You get to see a lot of them. And that was such a big part of the healing process for those women, looking at the man and telling him what they had done, what he had done to them and how it made them feel, and now what they want for him. And that's sort of that piece of restorative justice that we've talked about before. It's a term rattling around the world a lot right now, but there didn't seem to be much of that for these women in the Golden State Killer case. And I did write down a quote. One of them said at the end of the sentencing at a press conference outside, she said, quote, and they were calling him Inmate D'Angelo. That was like a satisfying piece for them to be able to call him Inmate. And she says, quote, "And Inmate D'Angelo is now behind bars and our safety has been restored," end quote. And she just didn't seem convinced. Has your safety been restored? Was D'Angelo out there? You know, look at this man in this wheelchair. Your safety hasn't been restored because there are other D'Angelos out there. This is the problem. Nothing has been solved, right? Catching D'Angelo, yes, now he's going to be punished. But that's not bringing any satisfaction to the victims because they know that nothing has solved, nothing has changed. And this, in my opinion, as far as I can see, does nothing to solve any of that. And I think that's what probably prompted some of them to want to do their own investigations and just find out who this man was. And like you said, the normal life that he lived, one woman remarked, this guy has daughters and granddaughters, and they showed like tender photos of him like holding his granddaughters. And what a weird like compartmentalization in your brain to, you know, be bonding with your granddaughters when also having broken into women's homes and done these horrible things to them. It's such a weird, fascinating.
I was shocked when they said he had three daughters. I was like, what kind of, how do you reconcile that as a human being? I guess I know the answer. Yeah, you just compartmentalize it. You say, that's the past, it's gone, and just never look at it. I understand why they wouldn't want to, but I really wanted to hear from some of those people. I know we got to hear from, I think, a niece.
You mean from D'Angelo's family?
Yeah, I would have liked to hear from the direct family. I know it has nothing to do with me, and I can totally see them wanting to have their privacy respected, but you just want to hear, like, what their thoughts are about the whole thing. I know it would be so wild for them to do that, but I don't know. What did you think about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're probably trying to hide as much as possible. The nephew that came on, the bald guy, D'Angelo's nephew that came on, he had the most screen time. That guy was kind of strange. You could tell he was completely shattered by it, and he's just making some sort of effort to be like, it's not us. We're like normal people. It's cool. He was also super dramatic and strange at times.
He was a strange guy. He struck me as, and maybe this is why people don't want to go on camera, but he struck me as someone who like really was happy for his time in the limelight. But that's totally unfair. I don't know. I feel bad saying it, but
it crossed my mind.
You know what what blew me away too is all of these people have these like horrible assaults in their lives. Even the people, I think it was D'Angelo's niece who was saying that he treated her like the father she never had,
right?
And she really like loved him and just couldn't like reconcile it, and she had her own assault things where people had broken into her home and basically done the Golden State Killer routine to her. I mean, and it just makes you go, God damn, it's a dark, dark world, huh, George?
It is. And Michelle McNamara, to bring it back to her, she had her own story of abuse when she went to Ireland. I mean, it's everyone. Every woman you know has a story. I know they say it's like 1 in 3. I feel like it's 100%. I feel like any woman who has reached adulthood has some harm that has been done to them by men. And it obviously varies in severity. But
yeah, I mean, coming to understand that is really important. And even if it's not like a full-on break-in rape situation, it's like you can't walk down a street without some asshole screaming something from their car at you as a woman. And it's just no wonder they're into true crime, because you have to feel unsafe all the time, and you got to find some kind of angle to understand that maybe will save your life at some point, which is a really fucking sad place to be.
Yeah, totally. They brought that up slightly in the finale a little bit, right? Someone said that. I think it was
Karen from, yeah. My Favorite Murder, right? She was like, this is why the typical demographic of true crime fans tend to be younger women.
Right. And Ed C. and I have talked about this several times. Like, why are we so into this stuff? Why has true crime taken off? And Karen Kilgariff definitely explained it better than he and I have ever been able to, but we've sort of stumbled upon the similar thoughts. I mean, obviously different for us because we're men, but it's a gross world, man. Have you seen Don't Fuck with Cats?
I actually have, yes.
Okay. So a big theme for Don't Fuck with Cats is the citizen detectives. I don't think they were called that in Don't Fuck with Cats. This was the first doc or first time ever I had heard the term citizen detective, which is sort of what I aspire to be. You know, I'd love to take Dark, Dark World in the future and like actually try to like investigate a cold case. You know, right now I'm just reporting on cases that have already been dealt with, but it would be fun to like try and dig up some local cold cases, something like that. So I like the idea of the citizen detective. You don't have the resources that police detectives have, but other than that, I mean, you have the same abilities that they do. And it's pretty empowering. I like that all these people, you know, Michelle brought in all these other writers with her own writing. Like, they were drawn to her, and then they started working together. And it seems glamorous, like I'm saying I want to do it, but there's so much, like, tedious, like digging through papers and police reports, like that stuff seems so unappealing, but it's so important, you know, like that's how they find these things, like any tiny nugget, like when she found those cufflinks, you know, on eBay, and she's like, oh, these might be, and it didn't pan out, but like, that was like a week of work for her, like discovering these cufflinks and then looking them up to see if maybe they belong to the killer. And then that lead doesn't work out. But it's like, that's the job, you know?
Right. I mean, you can see why it's really hard, you know, it's hard to be a detective. The things fall through the cracks. There's endless paperwork and things that you have to do. I mean, there's shots of Michelle when she gets access to all of the police files, and there's just boxes upon boxes. And yeah, you got to think those are filled with papers. Each paper could have some nugget in it. You have to fine tooth comb every single piece of paper in those boxes. I mean, listen, yeah, you no wonder she's popping Adderall every day.
Yeah, and exactly. I want to talk about that for sure. But yeah, and just knowing that in those boxes, there's probably like six relevant pieces of paper and everything else is not. And then ultimately, none of those boxes meant anything. It was 23andMe and then stealing some shit from his garbage. You know? That's it.
But ultimately, you know, you can't get to stealing stuff from his garbage and 23andMe unless you have all that legwork, unless you have all the spotlight that Michelle McNamara was able to shine onto this.
Yes, this is true. There are cases, and this is where genetic genealogy with crime solving can be problematic, is there have been cases where detectives haven't done the legwork. They just run the DNA through and then they go, sweet, we got a match. And they go arrest the guy without doing a proper investigation. And DNA, it used to be a nice thing to go, you know, we have all this circumstantial evidence, but we don't really have the smoking gun. Then you land on the DNA and you go, fuck yeah, we got him. But when you reverse that process and you just go, cool, we've got a DNA match, and there's no other investigation, it makes you feel a little nervous or uncomfortable. This is happening too with the facial recognition crime solving that's going on now. Have you heard about some of the problems they've had with that?
Well, yeah, because it's inherently racist because they think all black people look the same. I mean,
yeah, right? The American ones. Yeah, like there's different servers. Like in Asian countries, they're really good at recognizing Asians, but they're not so good at recognizing white people. And here it's the other way around. And of course, no system is good at recognizing black people. They're always going to be the most persecuted. No, like no matter what technology or what thing we find, black people get the short end of the stick every time. It's so disheartening.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a traffic ticket a while ago, and I had to do a, like, you know, one of those classes where you sit in and they talk to you, and it's always run by cops or retired cops. Right. And they open it up to questions, and so people ask questions, and they're wide-ranging, you know, they're talking about being a detective, murder, you know, all these different things, nothing to do with traffic school. Anyway, one of the things I remember that stuck with me is that the detective was saying, he's like, now with CSI and true crime and DNA and all these things, people now, juries, want to see that stuff. They want to see the DNA evidence. They want to see that smoking gun. Because if it's all circumstantial, they still don't believe it. And they say, well, why can't we like have a bullet entry chart that shows exactly the impact like it shows in CSI when someone gets shot? And he was sort of lamenting that change. And I thought that was funny that you brought that up because it can be helpful, but if now that's all they rely on, yeah, that seems like it could be problematic, especially when you consider that DNA, while it can be very specific to one person, is already 99.9% the same for every human being.
Right. This, I think that's a big reason why they came up with all these forensic junk sciences like blood spatter and teeth mark evidence, and all that stuff has since been proven to be pretty much bullshit. The Innocence Project just has to do so much work to reverse all of that. And that's, I think, why juries are, like you said, want that smoking gun now, because so many innocent people have gone away on circumstance. But you mentioned Michelle McNamara and the Adderall. So as we mentioned at the top, I knew that she died. I knew she was dead, and so I knew that was going to be coming in the story. I didn't know how she died, and So I guess it was the fifth episode, the penultimate episode, where they revealed that she died. She died. Her husband, Patton Oswalt, discovers her in bed, dead, just died in the night, and they don't know what's happening. She was way too young to go. What was she, 46? Is that right?
Sounds about right, yeah.
And toxicology report comes back, and she's like looking like Elvis Presley. She's got every pharmaceutical you can think of in there, most of them narcotics. And what I thought was odd, so in that same episode, then they go into the McNamara family history. They talk about some of the depression that they had and in the family and some alcoholism with the great-grandparents, stuff like that. So, and maybe I missed this. I was stoned during that episode in particular. And because I feel like if they didn't explain this, it's a huge flaw with the show. And it would probably be the only one that I really think should be brought up as far as flaws go. But so they go into this family history, which is implying that, okay, this was an addiction issue with Michelle. But that was it. Then they didn't get into any of it. I thought maybe when they're going through her computers, there would be some journal entries about, damn, I keep doing all these opiates, and I hope Patton doesn't catch me, or, you know, nothing like that. So her entire family, all of her coworkers, everyone that she's closely involved with, no one had any idea that she was abusing tons of substances. I mean, it's hard to shield that from everyone in your life, especially being a parent and writing with deadlines. It's just so odd to me that not a single person knew. I'm not saying I don't believe it. Fine. But I was just hoping we'd get a little more on, okay, so what was she doing? Did she have a dealer? Was she going to doctors and getting these scripts? They didn't address any of that, right?
Certainly not how she like got the drugs, which is interesting. Although, I mean, not that hard to understand. I feel like doctors will write a prescription for any drug for Americans. Yeah, sure, we'll give you, take 100 more milligrams. Right. I know Patton at one point said that she brought it up, but he said that she talked about it so flippantly that it never like raised any alarm bells. But what if you think about what she's saying, it's incredibly intense. She says, well, you know, I'm fine in the morning because I'll just take some Adderall that gets me going, and then at night I can't really sleep, so I just take Xanax and I'm fine.
That's right. Okay. I vaguely remember that now.
I've, you know, never been prescribed either of those drugs, but I've taken them both recreationally, and they're no joke. To combine those on the same day is truly wild. And I feel like, at least the way they frame it, that maybe she didn't have the issues before she started working on this book, and now she's just facing deadlines coming up. She's never written a full book before, so she's trying to get through this. She's trying to push through deadlines. She's trying to go through endless boxes of papers and police files and trying to solve a crime. And so she starts burning the candle at both ends. And, I mean, you can see that. I don't think anybody could take those two drugs every day and not die or have some terrible heart issue or...
Yeah, not to mention... There were plenty of others in her bloodstream, too.
I wanted to ask you specifically about the drug thing. I don't know. Does your audience know about your past?
Yeah, it's been discussed.
So, yeah, I just wonder, I don't know. Like, I guess, do you think there's something fishy going on there? Like, do you think that Patton should have maybe seen something? Should he have noticed, or any of the family members? I will say, you know, if she's working on this book, she's very probably much alone. I think they said she got her own hotel room at times mm-hmm. to do the work, so she wouldn't even have to be around the kid.
Yeah, this is why I wanted more, like, a little more info, because I don't think we got enough, like... Had anyone seen warning signs before? In college, was she a blackout drunk? Did she, you know, was there anything other than just this discovery one morning and then a couple comments to Patton when, you know, it's so easy to gaslight someone that you love when you're the addict, and because built in to the person that loves the addict is the desire to have it not be true, right? You don't want them to be an addict. You want to believe them when they say they're going to be okay. And so I can totally sympathize and empathize with Patton for not knowing. I'm sure he kind of beat himself up a lot about not knowing. And, you know, he did, like you mentioned, that Michelle was like, oh, no, it's fine. I do this all the time. And there's a part of him that just wants to accept that answer and go, okay, yeah, it's Michelle. It's Michelle. She's good. She's good. And because you don't want to deal with the other part of that, like, oh shit, what if she really has a problem? Then that's something we have to deal with, you know? So it's so easy to get that kind of cover, but it's hard to do that many drugs for an extended period of time and not fall into stealing, lying, sickness, irresponsibility, you know. So I just want to know, like, what kind of a time frame were we working with? Has she been doing this for years? Was it just a couple of months? And so I just wanted a little more info. So I can't really say, you know.
Yeah, they certainly made it seem like it was like a new thing, right? And she was only doing it to get through the work of the book and the case. So they've definitely framed it that way, which if we take that on face value, makes sense.
Yeah, a lot more easy to stomach if that is the case.
You know, do you have any experience with Adderall?
Yeah, I have some experience with Adderall.
Because it I feel like if you take it, you can lie to anybody. You can get away with almost anything. It's
how do you mean?
Well, it's the opposite of something like Xanax, where it's basically speed, right? It's like a cocaine speed sort of drug, except, you know, it doesn't have the hard edges of those.
Yeah, not as much euphoria, but yeah.
But if you take enough, you really start to feel like God. and I could see her maybe doing that and then, you know, being able to totally skate by and totally laugh everything off, because she probably believed it too. She was like, well, okay, I'm just doing this for this time because I know I got the deadline. The thing about Adderall too, like I was saying, it's kind of almost like speed, you know, which like alters your perception of reality in a certain way, I feel like. And if you're already dealing with heinous crimes and reading about and imagining and then having to put your own voice into writing it, you're really going down the rabbit hole then. So it totally makes sense that she couldn't sleep, you know, was having terror, like paranoia and nightmares. Because I feel like that drug combined with the work she was doing on that particular case is going to drive anyone into a really terrible spiral. And say, well, I guess I'll just take a Xanax to sleep. And then now you're in a really bad way.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. Like, she went deep on this case. And there has to be if she is lying to herself as well, that's understandable. But I wonder if it was new enough that she didn't really even know what she was fucking with, you know? It's possible.
That's actually another good point. Like, you don't know especially if she's just borrowing a few pills from a friend, if she didn't have prescriptions, you don't know how much to take. You know, they can vary wildly. You know, you can have a 100-milligram pill and a 20-milligram pill. They look the same.
Yeah, really, obviously, just, like, tragic and horrible. And I would have just liked a little more background on it. We didn't get it. Fair enough. We'll just have to assume, like you said, take at face value that it was just during this book and that there weren't warning signs. But something touching comes out of that, and that is her coworkers, I call them coworkers, but really the citizen detectives that were working on this with her, just being like, we're going to fucking finish this for Michelle. We're doing this story. We're doing this book. And like Patton giving them access to her laptops and, you know, going through there and completing the book for her, I thought was just super touching. And then that everyone at the end was just like, oh, we wish Michelle could have been here for this. Pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's great that they did that. I'm so glad they finished it, because it's still really powerful. And like, even the excerpts that they read during the documentary, I haven't read the book, but the excerpts they read are just really moving and personal and extremely well written. You know, I think that's the thing that everybody kind of talks about, is like, wow, she was such a good writer that she would just pull you in.
Yeah, she brings all that prose to true crime writing, which is typically very stale and very like, these are the facts. And she was able to bring her own life into it, you know, just talking about being in her kid's playroom while she's writing stuff and, you know, talking about this sick man who on the other end of the, she's got her darling baby playing in the playroom and then images in her head of,
I'm gonna kill you, fucking bitch.
Wild. How did they get those recordings?
By the way, that was my impression of voicemails that the Golden State Killer was leaving. That was, in case you don't know what the hell that was. Yeah, they got them because one of the victims, or she might have been a neighbor of one. It was someone that was afraid. Maybe he even told her he was going to come back and finish what he started or something. So she got her phone bugged because she was getting calls like that. So they just taped all of her calls. Super fucking creepy. Like, and it's, you know, this was the golden age for getting away with shit like this. You can't be that guy anymore. The heavy breather caller. This sounds like I'm upset that you can't do it anymore. But
oh,
no,
yeah,
like,
the good old days, huh?
Right. This was the time period. You know, people talk about, oh, we don't have serial killers anymore. Now we just have mass shooters. And it's true. Part of it is all the technology that has come about since, but also we're just wiser to it, and it's harder to pull things off. It was ghastly to me in one of the episodes when they were talking about the East Area Rapist and the Visalia Rapist or Strangler, I forget what they called him exactly, but all the same guy. You know, the women were shamed for being raped. I mean, first of all, it's barely even a crime. Guys were getting out in like a few months at most. There was no statute of limitations past, like, I think it was 2 years or something in the early 70s, and then it extended. Women were coming forward with these stories of what had happened to them and being asked, well, why? I mean, what were you wearing? Are you not locking your doors? Are you walking home by yourself at night? What did you do that brought this? I mean, and it wasn't sort of dog whistling. It was like direct, what did you do to make this happen to you? And that was gross and terrifying. What did you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I didn't look any different than it is today, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's come a little further.
But it's pretty recent that I feel like that sort of practice has been frowned upon now. Let's treat these victims like actual people and victims.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, if it goes to a trial, it's going to be the same thing. You know, defense attorneys are going to throw those same questions, what were you wearing, all that stuff at them. So it's still, I mean, it's still incredibly difficult, I think, for sexual assault victims to come forward.
You famously starred in Netflix's Unbelievable.
That's right. Nominated for an Emmy.
That's right. This was a story about the same thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. We talked about it on that pod, but so obviously it's terrible. It seems like murder was just sort of, murders and rapes were just sort of accepted in the 70s, I guess because the policing, they had no technology, there was nothing they could do. And when it's coming from one of their own, to come back to this, that the guy was a cop, he learned how to do this stuff. There's actually a part in Unbelievable where the two female detectives discover that the rapist had been using this book called like Rape Forensic Science. It's like a textbook that they give to cops. Like, yeah. It's basically telling you exactly how to get away with this.
So gross.
Yeah.
It's wild. Like you say, this is still pretty recent. Even if we go back to the 70s, I mean, it's only 50 years ago where women are blamed for being raped. I mean, that's, and you're right, it still exists in the culture. But just to the degree that it happened back then, it was so weird to me to like, you know, it really didn't seem like they were treated as victims at all. And it was so, I mean, I'm a pretty jaded person in general, but I think just some of the specific footage that they used of speeches that women themselves were making at the time, calling out other women for being raped, it was just really, I think it's episode 2 or 3, But that one hit me hard. And another thing you mentioned about rape or even murders in the 70s. Also, it's part of the culture, too. Like, people were hitchhiking. It was super common. So many of the, like, serial murders, if you want to get into, like, 70s and 80s serial murders, everyone's a hitchhiker. It's, like, so common. And I remember, like, asking Mom even, like, did you hitchhike like around then? She's like, oh yeah, we did it all the time. And I'm just like, that's so odd because it seems to us today in the true crime world so obvious, like that's a huge no-no. You're gonna get murdered. And it was happening all the time back then, but people still did it. So it's funny how much things can change in 50 years, but obviously it changed sooner than that with the hitchhiking. It's not that popular of a thing to do anymore, but man, it's like you said, I mean, women... One reason they may be drawn to true crime is as sort of a survival manual. And you wonder how if that survival manual had existed earlier, you know, how much this stuff would have, how much earlier some of this would have been diminished.
Yeah, I'll just jump in on something else you said, talking about the women almost seeming like they're blaming other women for being the victims of rape. You know, what another thing that was really jarring to me and just completely heartbreaking was when the victims would talk about their families just ignoring it or completely turning against them. You know, the parents not wanting to talk about it and all that stuff. And we know that that is probably the worst thing you can do for trauma is just bury it.
Right.
People have to talk it out. They have to see people. Therapy at that time was considered like head shrinking and sort of frowned upon. People, you know, say things like, you know, you're a mental midget if you don't, if you go to therapy, things like that. And it's just so tragic. Like, I really hope that we have come and made some strides in that area.
Yeah. Well, I guess, and we can wrap this up unless you have any other thoughts about it. Maybe just do some general thoughts about the series as a whole. I think we said at the top, really well produced, really well put together. Shout out Liz Garbus, one of the great true crime directors, one of my favorites. She's got a huge body of work. So nice to see her up there again. And, you know, overall, I think I'm giving this a B+, A minus territory. Nah, B+. I'm going to stick with B+. It wasn't my favorite, but really good. What about you, Ben?
Yeah, I feel the same. I mean, I think the direction, the production of it, the shots that they get, the combination of different multimedias that like they weave together to tell the story and some poetic imagery and also some, you know, just police photos. I always find that stuff really interesting and it keeps me engrossed. Yeah, I give it a 9 out of 10. Big fan.
Nice.
Loved every episode. So, yeah.
Yeah, I really liked how they'll, you know, just a cool device to be like, oh, it's too bad we don't have footage of Michelle and her citizen detective buddies wheeling out all the boxes from the police station. Well, Michelle's not here, but we have her buddies, so let's literally film them bringing boxes out of a police station instead of, like, doing some kind of reenactment with actors or, like, you know.
Right.
They just found the ones that they did have and did it and made it seem like they were filming them coming out of the... It was really cool.
I can't get too much into the thoughts of how they did it as I'm watching, especially documentaries, because I'm thinking, like, this guy's just walking into a courtroom right now. Did they really have 4 cameras on him at different,
yeah,
like, size lenses and focal lengths? Like, and I just can't do that because I get totally out of it, so...
Yes, Bonnie, the ex-wife of Joe DiAngelo.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about her.
She appears in the last episode, and they're doing their interview with her in a hotel, so they decide to film her coming into the hotel lobby and then, like, going up the elevator into her room, and you can see how fucking uncomfortable she is with it. It's just such a weird thing. But I guess they did it because it's telling us, before we get to know who she is, that she carries some weight to her. She's an important talking head.
Yeah, I thought it was the way they introduced her. I thought it was going to be his wife, his current, you know, spouse,
currently,
if he had one. But no, it turns out she was the one who rejected him and made him into, like, a fucking lunatic.
Yeah, I didn't feel comfortable with that. This, and she mentions this, that people, because he mentioned her during some of his attacks, people saying that she was like a shitty wife that drove her man crazy and made him become a killer. That seems like such a unfair burden to place on her, because we know what a psychotic this man was.
Oh yeah. No, he's a complete psychopath. It has nothing to do with her.
But she's gotten that. People saying, like, oh, if fucking Bonnie hadn't driven him crazy, well, you know, people that hate women, our society in general, will say, oh, there must have been something that made him snap. It was his fucking bitch wife. That's what it was. And so you could tell in her interview, she was saying that. She was like, I choose not to put that burden on myself. But it's obviously something she's thought about, because people have said it to her. And he did mention her a couple of times in the attacks. And that's got to just make you feel so shitty. Ugh.
It just makes me angry. It just makes me so filled with rage that anyone would blame a woman for the things that this man did. And I mean, how serial killer, like, cliche, weirdo thing is it to be standing in the corner crying, going, no, I hate you, Bonnie. I hate you, Bonnie. Right before you kill someone. Like, I feel like that's what you write in, like, a $2 script.
Yeah, so cartoonish. And he's such a weird one that the way that he would just kind of live in their homes for a while.
Yeah, like eat their food and...
Yeah, I'm going to tie you up. And it's just sort of a power thing, right? It's like, I've invaded your life and I'm just going to live in this for a while. See what you got in the fridge, make myself a sandwich, and then I'm going to do heinous shit to you. Oh, God. What a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's you know, and then you see him. Boy, it's unsatisfying. Just this loser in a wheelchair, this like old decrepit man. It's like, really? We're going to send this guy to prison?
Well, he's playing it up. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I could see that. Pretending not to understand anything.
Totally. The defense attorneys are like, listen, man, your only chance of not going to the slammer or electric chair is for you to pretend like you're a senile piece of shit.
Yeah.
Although I think they showed him at like his second arraignment or, you know, I don't know what the proper legal terms are, but they show him a second time in the courtroom and looks like he's lost like 50 pounds.
Yeah, right.
He's not long for this world if he's even still alive.
Yeah, same thing happened with Larry Nassar, to bring him up again. Like he's arrested, he's kind of plump or just comfortable. And then when it's time for his like victim statements, he's just this gaunt, drawn, decrepit husk of a man. But yeah, I just there's a lot to unpack there with the justice, the way that this documentary ended. And to me, it didn't seem like any of the victims were satisfied. I think without even maybe they're not fully aware, or maybe they have different levels of awareness to just understanding that punishment isn't necessarily justice. And, you know, the problem still exists. That quote that the woman said, and now our safety has been restored. And then while saying that, absolutely knowing that it hasn't, that there's still... At every turn, there's another Joe D'Angelo.
Good shit, man.
All right. Yeah, I guess that's a good closing line. Well, thanks for doing this, brother. Give us your socials. Where can people follow you? Plug some stuff.
Oh, that's nice. On Instagram, I am at DevCrit, DevCritt, and Twitter at Devin Crittenden. Yeah.
Cool. Everyone go follow Devin. My little brother.
I did an episode of the show called Lucifer on Netflix, which comes out, I think, on Friday. I think it's season 5, and I think I'm in episode 2 or 3, so.
Right on. Are you like a demon?
No, I'm someone who's being interviewed by them about a crime. It's only a couple of lines, but.
Nice. All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. We'll follow you on the socials. Thanks again for doing this. And, everyone be safe and kind to each other.
I think that's a good sentiment, George.
Dark, Dark World is a bi-weekly true crime podcast available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, iHeartRadio, and just about everywhere else you can find podcasts. You can visit us on our website at www.darkdarkworld.com. There you will find our online store for various merch items, as well as all of our contact info, including all of our social media profiles. You can gain access to ad-free episodes by supporting us on Patreon for as little as $2 per month. There, in addition to ad-free versions of all of our episodes, you'll have access to bonus episodes, blooper reels, video, and a discount for our merch store. So check us out over there at patreon.com/darkdarkworld. That's patreon.com/darkdarkworld. If you're enjoying the show, please tell your friends and family about it and consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It's really beneficial to the show and it goes a long way. I've been Jordan Crittenden. Thank you for listening.